This is the Better Reading Podcast platform with stories behind the story, Jane's Be Better podcast, My Book Chat with Caroline Overington, and more. Looking for a particular podcast? Remember, you can always skip to it.
Welcome to the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story, brought to you by Belinda Audio. Listen to Belinda audiobooks anywhere, everywhere.
Hi, this is Cheryl Arkell from the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story. We talk to authors about how they came to tell us their story. Diane Armstrong, welcome back to Better Reading.
You. Thank you very much.
We've had Diane in before and we're in office doing this in person, which I love. I so much prefer it to Zoom. Now, you've been well.
Thank you.
Yeah?
Yes.
Diane is no stranger. She is known to this podcast. She's known to Better Reading. All our readers out there, I know, adore you. We've chatted before about Diane's childhood, arriving from Poland, and life as an award-winning journalist. You've had such a big career. She has written 7 previous books, including Dancing with the Enemy and The Collaborator. Today, she's written a new book. It's called The Wild Date Palm, and she's here to discuss this book, and it's a tale of espionage, passion, and sacrifices set in the Middle East during World War One. It's based on an astonishing true story, and it asks, what are you willing to die for? In this day and age, it's such a big question, isn't it?
Yes.
What are we willing to die for?
Yes, because we all know what we're willing to live for, what we want to live for, but this is a much bigger question, isn't it?
It's just really so hard what's happening in the world. Tell me firstly a little bit about The Wild Date Palm, and I want to know where the idea came from.
Well, all my ideas really come from somewhere in left field, from the footnotes of history. And this particular one started when I was on a tour of Israel some years ago, and as we were driving around near the coast, the guide just casually pointed out of the window and she said, oh, can you see that pretty little town among the vineyards, that Zichron Yaakov? The amazing Aronson family lived there, and the young people in the family formed a spy ring, and they spied on the Turks because they wanted the British to win the war. This is World War One we're talking about. And as she said that, I thought, that's interesting. I better find out. And of course, I did what we all do when we want to know some more. I Googled frantically when I got home, and there it was, the Aronson family with their daughter and their son and the daughter's charismatic lover, and they formed a spy ring. And they really challenged the might of the Ottoman Empire, which was the ruler in that area at the time.
We spoke, you and I spoke a little bit about this because we did a Q&A a couple of weeks ago. And you know, when I got off that, we were speaking on Zoom, when I got off that, I thought about you talking about how the idea came to you while you were travelling. And I love travel. You know, I live in San Francisco for certain months of the year. I went to Mexico this year. And people often ask me, why do I like travelling? And I thought about what you said that in that during that Q&A, that you heard, you know, the guide told you that, and that was the seed of a story. And then I thought about that, and I thought, it's part of the reason why I like travel, because you are hearing many, many stories. Because sometimes when you're home, you tend not to be as adventurous as going out on a guided tour or, you know, walking into a city that you've never known or whatever. And I think travel delivers story almost every day.
Absolutely. Well, my previous book, Dancing with the Enemy, that also originated when I was on the island of Jersey in the Channel Islands, and we had a very unusual tour guide in the face of a 92-year-old gentleman who arrived in a sports car wearing a baseball cap and big sunglasses. And what he didn't know about the history of Jersey during the occupation, during the Second World War, wasn't worth knowing. And again, after I went home, I just knew that somehow this was going to turn out to be a historical novel as well. So I think you're right. I think you're perhaps more open to different ideas, and maybe you engage differently with the people that you meet.
Yeah, I think so. And also too, I guess you're a bit more open to learning and a bit more observant because you're in a new space.
Yes, I definitely think that you're more observant because you've come to experience something different.
That's right. And you're looking for something different, aren't you?
Yes. And of course, while I was driving around Israel, hearing this story from the guide, I mean, to think of young people in some little backwater during World War One deciding that they were going to hand intelligence to the British because they were going to help them win the war. I mean, that is really, that took a lot of guts, didn't it?
And this is kind of off the subject but on the subject, talking about story. I really like catching public transport. And so during COVID, my wings were clipped in a way because I don't know, I feel as though with driving, I'm not as on as I am with public transport. And so I like catching trains and I like catching buses. And I've reflected on that as well because when I'm in San Francisco, they are all drivers and I'm the only person on the bus. You know, like there's just, if I go to a dinner and people say, oh, how did you, oh, where's your car or whatever? I say, no, I caught the bus. I don't have a car there anyway. I caught the bus. And they're like, the bus? But do you know, I learn more about what's happening in a city when I'm on the bus and when I'm on a train. And you see people interact and you see people have conversations. And that's where the stories are. They're not in your car driving around.
Well, you get the atmosphere as well when you're sitting
Don't
on the
you?
Bus. When you're driving, all you're doing is watching the traffic, hoping that you take the right turn when you have to, that you don't end up in the wrong lane. And you're focused on getting there.
Yeah.
So it's a very different experience, isn't it?
It is. And I do. I see so many different things on a bus. I see tenderness. I see sadness. And I'm always thinking about what's that person's story? You know, where are they going? Why are they crying? Or why are they happy?
Yeah, well, that's the other thing. All people tell you that people will tell the person sitting next to them on the bus things that they won't tell someone that they know very well.
That's
so
true.
That happens as well.
Yeah, that is so true, actually. I really, really, I feel as I get to know people better. Now, I want to talk about historical fiction and I want to talk about the balance with getting historical accuracy and fiction. How do you work with that?
Well, there are a few challenges involved in historical fiction and you've just touched on one of them. You're writing something about a situation that happened. And you have to be accurate with dates because there'll be someone who will pick you up that on the fact that it wasn't a Monday but it was a Tuesday. And, you know, the readers are very discerning
they
pick up all kinds of things. So it has to be accurate. On the other hand, it can't be a history lesson. So fascinated as I am with history, things that have really happened, while I'm writing, I'm very mindful of the fact that I can't allow my fascination with history to take over the story because I'm not writing a history book. People haven't picked this book up to learn history. They've picked it up because of the personal aspect and that's what I'm interested in, the people. But then, of course, I have to put in some things to explain the context of where those people are living and what's happened and why they are doing what they're doing. So it's a balance. And the balance is, in my mind, it's got to be 90% story and 10% history. And when I catch myself delving too deeply into historical perspectives, I stop myself and I think, hang on, you're not writing a history book, you're writing something where the history is just a prop, really. It's a context for the story of these amazing people.
Do you know, we spoke about a little bit about this the last time we spoke too, and I think I might have asked you what the fascination, what do you think the fascination is with historical fiction? And I can't remember now exactly what you said, but you did say something to me about bringing life, bringing history to life.
I think that's part of it.
Yeah.
It does bring history to life, but I think it also makes us realise that things really don't change that much, and that the preoccupations and the good and evil that people
Human
have
nature.
Done in the past, exactly, are repeated over and over again. So we identify with the people in the past, but at the same time, we like to understand the different life, the different world in which they lived and how it's different from the world that we know. So I think there were the two things that fascinate people. Like, you know, I went to see a historical movie the other night, and it's the same thing. I knew a little bit about the people, not that much, but seeing it come to life, it was a different experience altogether.
Absolutely. I want to talk, Diane, about how you came to writing, how you transitioned from being a journalist to a writer, and why.
Well, I've always wanted to write. I think I told you last time we were speaking about this, that when I was seven, I told my mother that when I grow up, I want to be a writer. And I think there are several reasons for that. One is that I'm an only child. I grew up in a world without computers, smartphones, television, and all the rest. I read. So I was completely immersed in a fictional world right from the minute I could learn to read. So writing was my destiny in a way. And I started off, in fact, I wrote my first story when I was about, I think, barely 12. I was in primary school. I'd arrived in Australia only 2 years earlier.
From Poland.
From Poland.
Yeah.
And I wrote this, when I think about it, this really melodramatic story of love and loss. I mean, where that came from.
Age of seven.
At the age. No, no, this was, I was
11.
I was old, yes.
Oh, sorry.
Older then.
Yeah.
But still.
So at the age of 11, you're writing about love and loss.
Yes, yes. The irony of life was clear to me even at that age. Isn't that interesting?
It is.
Like,
it really
you know,
is.
Because I knew that my, you know, I still remember the last line of that story was, she got the part, but she lost the man.
Oh, I love it. But do you think, actually, that's a really interesting point, and we haven't talked about this before. Do you think because you're an 11-year-old that had immigrated, that there is a maturity that comes with that? I think being a migrant, because my parents are Lebanese, right? And I was born here, but the two middle ones were born here. My parents came and went before they settled. And I feel that that gave you a certain maturity because I kind of felt we had to grow up really quickly.
I think that's true. And also I'm a child Holocaust survivor.
Yeah.
And I found out when I went back to Poland many, many years after the war, many years after, and I came across the priest who saved our life, and he described me as a three-year-old who was so timid and so anxious that whenever I spoke, which wasn't very often, whenever I took part in a conversation, he said, he still remembered, I would look anxiously at my parents as if to say, was it all right for me to say that? So I grew up really, I think I've always been more comfortable in writing things down than in coming out and expressing them, you know, in words the way we are today. And I think that really segued onto writing because writing became a very good way of expressing myself in a non-confrontational, in a non-worrying way.
Okay. So you decided to be a journalist?
Well, I really decided to be a writer.
Yes.
I never really decided to be a journalist. It just happened. I didn't mean it to happen. To me, being a writer meant writing books. But somehow I got sidetracked into journalism.
Well, I guess at some point, I mean, it's more of a career path, isn't it, than writing?
Yes. I never intended that to happen.
No.
But it happened and the articles were published. So that was good. And I was seduced by that. That was wonderful. But deep down, I always wanted to write a book.
And then when did you make the leap?
I made the leap about 20 years after being a freelance journalist.
Wow. And well, it's a long time.
It was a long time. And what happened was my parents, I was very lucky because a lot of my friends' parents, Holocaust survivors, never talked about what happened to them. They didn't talk about their families who'd been murdered. They didn't talk about their traumatic experiences. But my parents did. Mm. And I heard these amazing stories about my relatives, most of whom I had died, been killed before I knew them, and the others were dispersed around the world. And it gradually came to me, especially when one of those relatives in America died, and I suddenly realized that the window of opportunity for me to write about this family was fading day by day. And if I didn't get a move on, it would be too late. Mm. So that's what really inspired me to pack my tape recorder in my bag and to set off around the world, which I did for 6 weeks. I traveled to America, to Poland, to France.
And how old were you roughly?
Oh, well, by that time I was in my 40s.
Right, okay.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
I thought it was going to be a book about my relatives, and it wasn't until I can't say it was an accident, by some amazing stroke of destiny, I came across the priest who had saved us during the war. And that's when I realized that this book was not going to be just about my relatives, that it was my story. Mm. And that became Mosaic, my first book. Mm. And that's what got me started on writing.
And that just took off, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm still getting emails about it from people all over the world.
Mm-hmm. So you kept writing. So you had success with Mosaic and you kept writing. And at what point did you take a break from writing?
Well, it wasn't an intended break, but in 2011, my husband died. We'd been married for 51 years and it was a very good marriage and we'd been very happy. And he had been ill for some time. Mm. But it's always a shock when it happens.
Absolutely.
So it wasn't that I had intended to take a break from writing.
So did you take a break while you were nursing him, or when he died you felt that you couldn't write anymore?
I felt I couldn't write any books. I did write articles. I wrote personal articles about the first trip that I did on my own, which was traumatic in many ways, but I wrote about that. And I wrote different things that I was interested in, but nothing that required the kind of discipline and concentration that a book did. It didn't come to me. Mm. And so
I've heard that. I've heard that from authors who've lost partners of all ages, you know. And people often say to me that they feel at the time, their grief is so deep, I think, that they'll never write again, you know, that I've heard that. And then, you know, at some point something happens, there's a trigger.
Yes. Well, while I wasn't writing a book, Steven Spielberg, who organised a fund to take down, record oral histories of Holocaust survivors, and I was asked to be one of the interviewers in Australia. And that, of course, gave me lots of ideas that translated into articles. So I was, in a way, keeping my hand in. I couldn't stop writing, but this wasn't a book. This was just articles inspired by the people that I talked to. And it really wasn't until 6 years later that, again, I heard a story from the footnotes of history that I thought, I have to write this book. And that became The Collaborator.
Talk to me about your grief in terms of to be with somebody for so long. You must have been so lost for a time. How did you kind of work through that?
I was very lucky in some ways. I have most wonderful community of friends. And
that helps.
I hear constantly from newly widowed people that for the first few weeks, people come round and then nothing. Well, that didn't happen to me. I don't remember a single night that I spent alone eating dinner on my own. There was always people either invited me to their place or came over or took me out. And this happened a lot. So that doesn't compensate for the loss of your partner.
But it helps.
But it certainly helped. And I've got wonderful children.
Yeah.
And they were also, you know, very, very sensitive. And my little granddaughters were then, I think they were, the youngest one was five and the twins were seven. And I'll never forget the first evening that after the funeral, they came over to my place and one of the seven-year-old twins picked up a teddy bear that we had somewhere and she put it in bed beside me.
Aww.
She said so that I wouldn't feel that I was alone.
Yeah. Don't you love grandchildren?
The best.
They're so special. Aren't they the best?
The best.
The best. Yeah. I agree. I agree. So anyway, so your first book, I mean, did we talk about how you, was it that you felt it was the right time? Were you being drawn to writing? How were you feeling to get back to writing?
Well, that's a good question. I'm thinking about it. By then, I was with my new partner. Someone who we had known each other since we'd been at university.
Oh, how lovely.
He was, when we met, he was dating my best friend and I was already dating Michael and he married her and I married Michael. But we stayed friends for many, many years. And then 20 years later, we had sort of drifted apart a little bit. But when I heard that my then best friend had died, I got in touch just to say I was really sad to hear that she'd had died.
Yeah.
And Michael and I invited him over and it was like old times.
Yeah,
and
lovely.
It was just like picking up where we'd left off. And then I think about 6 months later, Michael died. And gradually he started calling me and making suggestions.
Diane, is that a book?
What a story, huh?
What a story. Have you not written about that yet?
No.
Why?
I don't know. Maybe it's too personal. I don't know. Here I am telling you about it on radio.
Let's not tell anyone.
We'll keep it to ourselves. Yeah, look, and he's the most wonderful man.
I love this story.
And look, we've just been so happy together. And I was Auntie Di to his daughters, and he was Uncle Bert to my children. So, do you know what? I'll tell you something. I came across a whole pack of air letters. Do you remember air letters?
Oh, I do. Okay. I wrote many myself when I was living in London. Yeah.
Well, when Michael and I were living in London for nearly 4 years, and in that time we didn't have phones.
No.
So my parents and I used to exchange air letters. They wrote two a week.
Yeah.
And I kept them.
Yeah,
and the other day I found them. And in one of those letters, I found my mother saying that Bert and his then wife had come over for dinner because they were back in Sydney and they were telling my parents all about us in London.
Oh, how beautiful.
So it's all...
Yeah, yeah.
Again.
And do you think he was the inspiration for you writing again? Were you feeling...
I was feeling happy again. I was feeling more relaxed and and content. My mind was ready to concentrate on a big effort of research and writing. Mm. And, yes, I think that had a lot to do with it.
Do you know, I know a few people who've lost their husbands and they've repartnered. But they also, the relationship that they're in allows them to grieve their previous husband. And I often think that's so generous of the new partner, but it does happen. And I guess it's something that can't be ignored.
Well, that's something that's definitely happened with us because my partner is incredibly generous and he's often quoting, because he and Michael were good friends.
Yeah.
And he's often quoting Michael to our, you know, friends. He remembers him saying this or doing that.
Yeah.
So we've got Michael's photographs all over our house.
Yeah, that's lovely, isn't it?
Yes.
I like that generosity.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. Did we get sidetracked here? I think we did a little bit. Okay, back to the book. Back to the book. Okay, so talk to me about how many books from Mosaic to where we are now.
This is number 8.
Number 8. Yeah, wow. Okay. And are you working on something else?
Thinking about it. Yeah. But again, I'm still too deeply involved with the Wild Date Palm to really put my mind seriously to the next thing. But I have an idea and I've done a bit of reading and researching, so but I'm not ready yet to start writing it.
Yeah. I guess in a way you have to kind of farewell the characters and make sure that they're gone and they're settled and they're somewhere else.
Well, do you know what? That's very true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that you can clear your head and write.
Yes.
Yeah.
At the moment, they're all with me still.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I can imagine that. Until otherwise, it must be confusing starting another when you've got those in your head and you're thinking, whoa. Okay, tell me about your process of writing in terms of like your day-to-day. Like, are you 9 to 5? Are you 2,000 words? Are you...
None of that.
Shaking your head.
No, none of that.
What do you do?
Yeah. Well, what I do is firstly, I do a lot of research before I even think of starting to write. I feel I have to know a lot about the people, about the background, the setting, the context before I feel confident enough to start writing.
Mm-hmm.
When I've done a lot of research, which could take well over a year and often does, then I sit down and I start writing. Now, I don't have a time frame in the sense that I have to write for 2 hours or that I have to write 2,000 words. I write as long as I feel that the ideas are flowing.
Mm-hmm.
That can take an hour and a half. It could be two, very rarely more than two.
Mm-hmm.
And then I get up and I do something else. I might go and do some shopping or I might just go for a bit of a walk, make a phone call. And then I get back to it in the afternoon. And again, I just write as long as I feel the ideas are coming.
Yeah.
And then there comes a moment when I just know that there's nothing going to happen anymore, that I'd better just leave it. And then the following day, I reread what I've written. And I'm an inveterate editor anyway. As I'm writing, I keep changing things. So the following morning, I go through it and see how that looks to me now.
Mm-hmm.
And then I move on from there.
And do you set a time limit? I mean, are you ever under a deadline?
Yes. Well, I usually have a contract with my publisher.
Yeah, right.
And contracts are very good because they concentrate your mind wonderfully.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I've never gone over time, so that it helps.
Mm.
But that's really the only kind of time constraint.
Mm.
Otherwise, I just write as much as I can when I can. And I just trust that it's going to happen.
And when you deliver your book to your publisher, is there a coming and going, like the editorial process? Do you enjoy that? Is that something that you...
Well, it's interesting.
Yeah.
What happens is I hand in the manuscript and she sends it, then she reads it, and if she's happy with it, she passes it on to the person who's going to be my editor, who for the past umpteen years has been Linda Fennell, and she's wonderful.
Mm.
So she reads it, and then eventually she gets back to me with her feedback. Now, most of the time I can see where she's coming from, and I agree.
It's such a privilege, isn't it, being edited?
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
But sometimes I don't agree.
Yeah.
And she's terrific. So if I don't agree, you know, she...
But isn't that the process it's meant to be?
Collaborative.
Know? Yeah.
Yes, it is. But, you know, you tend to think, well, she's the editor and she must know better.
Yeah.
And so she thinks that this chapter should go somewhere else or shouldn't be there at all. Maybe it's something that she knows. Most of the time I can see that she's right. And I alter things. Just occasionally, I think, no, I really want this to be the way it is. And so that's what happens, for better or worse.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I mean, I don't know how you're doing it, but in the past it was always penciled by the editor, wasn't it? And that's a mark of respect to the writer.
Yes. Yes. And I feel very lucky to have such a sensitive and understanding editor.
Well, I think sometimes that's the magic of the business, isn't it? That each book comes out and it's been worked on not just by the writer. There are so many people championing that story, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's, you know, I feel as though that's rare in a lot of industries.
Yes, well, it's very time-consuming for all concerned. Mm. And, look, there are times, let's be honest, when I sort of wish that, you know, that it didn't take so long, because it does, it's quite time-consuming, because then it goes back to her, and then if she's happy with it, she passes it on back to the publisher and so on. So,
and it wouldn't be the only book she's working on as well.
No, but at the time it is.
Oh, is that right?
At
is that
the time
how it works?
It is, yes.
Okay.
So she might devote umpteen weeks to it at a time.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, no, it's an incredible process. Okay, so you haven't started the next one, but you will. So you'll be back to see us. Diane Armstrong, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, well, thank you. It's a delight to talk to you.
If you'd like more information about Better Reading, follow us on Facebook or visit betterreading.com.au.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by Belinda Audio. Belinda audiobooks are available on CD and MP3 from online booksellers and bookshops everywhere, or you can download from Audible, Google Play, or the iBook Store. We've also created our own app called BorrowBox that's available from both the App Store and Google Play. All you need to do to get it working is to download the app, join your local public library, and you'll gain access to the world's best collection of ebooks and e-audiobooks available for you to loan on your phone or your personal device. Belinda, we're here to enable you to escape, imagine, grow, and be inspired through the power of storytelling. Belinda Audiobooks. Anywhere, everywhere.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
If you enjoyed this podcast, leave us a review and check out the other podcasts on the Better Reading Network.